Welcome to the Real Estate Dads podcast. We've got our guest, Jonathan Way. Jonathan is a father to an 11-year-old daughter. He immigrated to the United States at the tail end of the Vietnam War with his parents, where they traveled, really were smuggled out of the country of Vietnam in a bullet hole ridden boat that they had to figure out how to get out of a dangerous area and eventually immigrate to the U.S. His parents were achievers of the American dream, encouraged all of their kids to become lawyers, doctors, CPA, the big three. And Jonathan found out that his path in life was also tied to the journey. There's ups and there's downs, but you have to have passion for life, passion for achieving, and passion for everything you're doing. And he calls himself an agent of love and life, and he wants to encourage others to live their lives that they want to and be a good father and person who is pushing forward for community involvement and progress with society. So Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
You came over when you were five, and if you don't mind asking, how old are you?
I'm 48 years old this year.
Well, 48. So Vietnam War ended, and so it was still happening when you were born. So you were a young kid.
Yeah.
Came over when you were five, and how was that journey? Like, how was that for your parents? A massive even exodus for them during that period of time.
Right. So that was a big change, because back then was kind of like little Paris, so you had freedom. We were living in Chinatown because we were actively Chinese, and we had a lot of businesses. My father was a dentist. So my father told one of us that my son has to be a dentist. So my brother had become a dentist. So my older brother took on that torch. So he became a dentist.
Just flat, hey, this is what you're doing. And like that, like choice was kind of like not there.
It wasn't there, because he said my grandfather was a dentist and you had to be a dentist, and that was it. And then he was like, either one of you is, I had two brothers. So I was the youngest one. So I was given a lot of pressure. Now my oldest brother said, you know what? I'll take the torch.
Okay. And this, your dad came over too when you were like your whole family, your two brothers and your parents.
Yeah, so we were, my dad was beaten, robbed by the Ho Chi Minh communist regime, the Viet Congs. We went to jail three times trying to escape the country. Me and my father was thrown in jail when I was very young, as a baby. We were caught trying to leave the country, basically, you know. So I was thrown in jail when I was very young, maybe 1-2 years old. I couldn't remember it because I was a baby, you know, I was young. And then, they beat him, and my uncle had to help him say, you know what, I'll give you money, you let him go. So we gave kind of bribery to bribe the guards, say, hey, you know, you let them go. I'll give you some money, you know, be quiet. He's okay. So and then the third time we found, you know, we don't escape on a boat, which is bullet ridden, with all millions of holes. And the guy said, we're leaving right now. And we started leaving, and it's just sort of sinking halfway because there's so many bullet holes. And it's like a pirate ship, you know. And then halfway, everyone was going to die. Like, I think 1,000 people in a boat, people was going to die in a boat. And then we tie ropes with my family. My uncle said, you know, we'll die right here because it's like Titanic, it's sinking right now. Then all of a sudden, you see like a fisherman boat from like a nearby island, China Island called Hainan. And he started rescuing us. Like this little fisherman. And we stayed for like a freaking month with no food, nothing, but starving. So my brother had to go steal food for us in the morning. So he went around stealing food for us. He was older than me, so he knew what's going on. So.
And you remember all this? You're telling this from memory?
This is a story my brother and mom told me. I remember a little bit of it, but I don't have a full picture, but my brother told me about that. He stole food that he had to go steal, and then he met a family. He said, okay, I'll give you a peach and orange. Give it to your brother, give it to your mother. And then that's what happened for a month for the shipping to fix the ship. Then the captain goes, I'm going to dump you guys here because, I want more money. And we're almost dying. So he took a small boat and back to Vietnam and just dumped the new boat there. So some young kid said, you know what? I have no idea how to drive this, but I'm going to drive it anyway. I don't care. At this point, we have nothing to do. We do or die. So the guy starts driving the boat, and he had no compass. We had no idea where to go. The guy goes, hey, you know what? I want someone to volunteer to swim all the way down there and see what that is over there. And he swam half a day. 8 hours, he came back. He was, that's Hong Kong. That's Hong Kong. Is it Hong Kong? I said, we're going straight there. Well, we're half fuel, but nothing left. We're going straight in there. And then, when we drove in there, we tried to put the British flag up, and the British, I go, well, you can't come in. You're not allowed. Who are you? You know, please identify yourself. And we just kept straight right in. And then we crashed, landed on the resort, Hong Kong. And the time was in the British Consulate. The IMR goes, you know what? I'll take you in as a political asylum. So we went to a refugee camp, the whole the whole boat. Some people died because of famine and disease, but we made it through that tragedy, and we went through it to Hong Kong, basically.
My word. What an amazing, harrowing story. So you made it to Hong Kong, and it's both your parents, your mom and your dad, and then you two older brothers.
Yeah, and then my uncle and their kids. I think it's like three or four kids. So we made it as a family. Then we're just from the refugee camp, and, you know, this, you know, it's a small refugee camp, and, you know, my mom was allowed to work certain hours and stuff like that until we had to get, my uncle came to America first, the older uncle, and he sponsored us to New Jersey, where I lived in the St. Joseph's Church, where he gave us like free rent from my dad, and then the low rent for, I think, $300 a month for like 5 years or something, until we get off our feet or something.
Wow, and that was in New Jersey?
Yeah, New Jersey, yes.
Yes.
Did your dad, was he able to practice dentistry in the U.S.?
No, because it's more higher standards in America, and you need the board certification, and he didn't have, he had a Vietnamese, which is not equal. So he did dental lab, but that didn't work out, and he became a mailman, basically, a mail carrier for the U.S. Post Office. So at the time, they said, hey, why don't you get a job here, because you get guaranteed almost like a pension or like a retirement savings, because it's quasi-government. And at the time, it was good. In the 80s, it was good. If you go get a job in the Post Office, you consider, you know, it's a good job, basically.
Security, for sure. Your parents had a little bit of a different, your mom and your dad, they had some different views on parenting or styles. You said they had a little bit competing views on what to have the kids do.
No, my mom and dad, well, my mom was really the raising us. So she just basically said, my father's here to be a dentist. So my brother became a dentist. I'm glad he likes it, because that's not following your passion. You know what I'm saying? But he likes it. So I'm happy he likes it. And for me, I can choose what I wanted to. And my two brothers can choose what I wanted, the other one, the middle one. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just chose accounting because I had no idea. You know, I fell in my lap, basically, accounting when I went to school.
She came to the U.S. You were five. Your dad's got to really do something new because he can't be a dentist. So you said you guys had some different businesses. So how was that coming to the U.S. and kind of having that American dream? Tell us about that. Because you hear that a lot. You hear people say how, you know, in today's world, the American dream doesn't exist anymore. But I love hearing these stories. And we've had a couple individuals who we've had interviews with where people have come to the U.S. and said, no, you know, we came from a place that it was rough. And then we came here and made things happen. And when I hear about your brothers and your parents and you being happy working in real estate, we haven't even gotten to the real estate portion yet. So how was that in regards to just the upbringing and everything for you guys once you got here and had to, I'll call it just, well, I want to hear it. I don't even know.
Right. So our upbringing was your typical poor family who came here from America who had dreams. The reason why I think my parents moved us here was for us to be better than them, because they were suffering under the communist regime, the Ho Chi Minh. So they had to leave. So she said, you got to study hard. So I was coerced to don't go out, don't go nowhere, stay home and just study. So I was kind of like locked in my room and said, you got to study, you got to study. And you know, it's boring when you're studying, right? You know how it is. You know, almost like we're studying. So I kept studying. So studying, and I got, you know, good grades and math. And I had a hard time in English because in somehow in this school here, I grew up in North Bergen. That English is really tough, like Shakespeare and all these things. Like, it was hard to like comprehend and analyze those protagonists and all these. It was very difficult for me. So I started taking extra classes to learn not how to speak English, but how to read and comprehend and understand between the lines, right? So, yeah.
No, I was just going to say, I can't stand Shakespeare.
So my English teacher was really, really tough. She made me sit over after class because I'm going to write your hands and fall off. I want you to write like nonstop until you understand all of it. I'm like, wow. So I sat there after class and just wrote for 2-3 hours.
So, and your parents, you know, with your dad being a dentist, so even when you were in Vietnam, you actually came from a relatively affluent family prior to even coming to the U.S. And what businesses did your family operate when you were here?
In Vietnam, my father was a dad. I had three maids in Vietnam. I was treated like a king, but after the war came, everything was tarnished and taken away. We had to hide gold in our shoes and our teeth because you don't want them to find your gold. Because the currency was devalued, like in Venezuela, it was like almost like nothing. So basically, you take gold. Gold was worth value, but we hid it in like our teeth, our molding, our under the walls to hide from the communist regime. Okay, that's what we had to do. And here, my mom, because my mom had to feed us to go to college, because she worked in a small little factory with a Jewish owner in New York City. She didn't make enough money, so she had to do part time. So I helped my mom on the weekends, wake up 4 o'clock in the morning, and go to do flea market or swap meet in California, but we call it flea market in New Jersey. We used to sell like sunglasses, wallets, and jewelry. So we did that to help pay for my mom leased a Toyota Corolla. So she paid for my car, and also she paid the rest. I took a student loan. So she helped pay for those bills for like leasing the car and for us while we're in college so she could make it through. Because my dad was only a mailman. You don't make much money as a mailman. My mom was only like a small like office clerk or something in a small Jewish firm. So it wasn't much money at all. Those two were like low to middle class, you know? So that's how we got Pell Grants.
But doing what it took. I mean, like when I hear this story, I mean, don't get me wrong, it doesn't sound like it was light by any means. But, you know, but what I love hearing about this is, you know, it sounds like your family really did everything that was necessary to improve the situation. You know, that's what I kind of love hearing from this, despite the fact that it sounds, you know, so harrowing.
So like my mom did that and I helped her. So me and my brother helped her, you know, go for a good morning. Spent the whole day. Sometimes it was raining. It was cold outside in front of Giant Stadium, which is Meadowlands Giant Stadium. That's where they had the flea market. On days it was like very cold and snowy. I could still go out there like when it was like, you know, heavy winds. But we had to endure the outdoor life because we had to make the money. We did that for like, I think a few, like at least 4, 5, 6 years. And after that, I got a job. Then I said, you know, let's not do this no more because we don't need this no more. I help my mom. So me and my brother each month contribute money allowance to my mom so she don't have to worry about this anymore.
So are you still doing that?
I think my brother, I pay for her like cell phone. We have free home for her. Because what happened when she's older now and we sold her home to pay high property tax, and she lives with my brother for free. And my dad's in a nursing home, so I visit him like today. I visit him every week, take him out to lunch. I pay for her cell phone. So I think she is for free from my mother and my father because she has free housing and free food and free cell phone bills. Everything is free for her. And my dad has a pension.
Did your parents, did they split up at some point?
No, they're together. But my dad got ill because of diabetes. He's 80 something now, 82. So he's in a nursing home because he can like walk like, he can walk like me and you basically normally.
And do they still see each other?
Yeah, they see it every day, almost every day. My mom goes there every day, almost every day. Yes.
Wow. Jonathan, I'm curious when, so you're working in a, you know, Wall Street CPA firm, you know, and taking care of your parents. And when was that? At what point was your daughter born, and when was the kind of the light bulb moment that you realized real estate was the path you wanted to take?
Yes. The aha moment, my daughter was born in after Hurricane Sandy, ironically, right after Hurricane Sandy. So she's born Halloween on 2012. So she came into my life, my beautiful angel, which I'm very blessed for. And what I realized was I bought some condos, which I thought I could buy, you know, a couple of them and hopefully leave my job because I read Robert Kiyosaki's book. But what I realized in his book, he doesn't teach you how to actually do it, but he gives you inspiration how to do it about real estate. So then what happened was when I realized, hey, wait a minute, this is not working because I'm making like $200 a month. That's it. All these one condo and get three condos, I'm getting $1,000 a month. It's like, that's not going to let me leave my job, right? It's like, that's not financial freedom. So, I decided to hire a mentor because I had no idea I don't know how to scale and get out of this. So I had to hire a mentor. So I hired Michael Blanc. I don't know if you know who he is. And he helped me, you know, in his program, he had a mentor named Drew, and he became very important in my life. And he helped me, you know, get my first multifamily and on my way to financial freedom, basically.
And tell us about that program with Michael Blanc. So, and I know some people who have done it, but I guess just if you're able to share, you know, what's the kind of program, like how does it work?
Yeah. Right now I'm a mentor for Michael Blanc because he saw me as a good student who did well. And he asked me to be his mentor, so I said, yes, I'll help you because I believe in his cause. His cause is financial freedom through multifamily to help people inspire, motivate, and help them achieve freedom. And then you can also help others as well. So you become an agent of, which I believe as well, is you have to be an agent of light and love and help others do good. And his program is just a 12-month program. If you join the program, he'll kind of promise you that you get a deal in 12 months. If not, for free, he'll extend it until you get your deal done with the mentor, and you're part of his ecosystem. You have a mastermind community, and we have like events. Like I'll speak on stage, talk about how my students are successful. We have weekly events about what's working, what's not working. Deal pitch every Wednesday. That's a new thing that started. Mentor each week or so has someone talk about different topics that, let's say, you want to bring forward to. We can help you. So that's his kind of community, or just how to buy your first deal. That's basically what his focus is on.
And, you know, and I want to come back to the parenting side, but now as far as your real estate career from, let's fast forward just in the growth. So you bought these four condos. That was like your first foray. you were like, hey, this is my first couple deals. And then where's your focus now? And how is that transition from then to present?
Right. So everyone in life, this is very important if you want to understand, everyone in life will go through a journey experience. That's part of the spiritual evolution of life. In your lifetime, there's going to be ups and downs. And during each one of them, we're going to have so-called what I call a crisis or a trigger point. My midlife crisis, I was depressed. I wasn't happy with Wall Street. I felt like I was in a rat race, in a matrix, you know, stuck in a box. I was tied to my desk most of the time. I couldn't leave. And I said, you know what? I'm so tired, but I'm just going to throw this away. So I told my wife, my wife was miserable. She had a new boss and I had a merger, which means when you merge in Wall Street, means you lose your job, merger acquisitions. But they saw my potential. They want to keep me. They didn't want to lose me. So then I tried out for a few weeks at a new firm. I didn't really like it. They treat me like I'm a nobody. They're like, oh, you are ex-New Edge. New Edge was a firm I used to work for. And new company was called SockGen. They said, oh, you're ex-New Edge. Yeah, like I'm a nobody. Like that's how you treat like you're nobody. So I didn't like that treatment because I was an ex-New Edge. I'm like, what is that supposed to mean? You know. So I told my wife, and my wife wasn't happy. I said, you know what? We got to just quit our jobs and let's do something else. This decision was not light. It was a very difficult decision. And most people would not do what I do. I was getting a very good high paying salary. So was my wife. We had been doing it for like, I don't know, 20 years or something, very long, like long tenure and established. And people in my position were scared or fearful. They would not do what I do. You know what I did? I gave him notice. My wife gave notice. I had a daughter who was like maybe a few years old, had no medical. We just quit our job. I had no medical. I called my brother. I said, listen, brother, I need your help. I need to save you for free for a little bit. So I moved from New Jersey to Dallas. That's where my brother moved to. Let me just crash in your couch or something. Me and my wife have a red bedroom and give me some time. I need to rethink everything over because I'm really not happy with my life. And he said, yeah, no problem. So then we just quit our jobs, sold our home. No medical, had a young daughter, no income coming in. At 1 month, I just sat soul searching myself and told my wife, I said, what should I do? And in fact, what's the next step for me in my life? You know. Then I came across Michael's SDA, his analytic tool and stuff like that. And then I said to my wife, hey, you know, I may join his program because I like his tool, because I like the Excel. And he told my financial freedom is what I need right now. We need financial freedom. We can't be like this, stuck in a rat race in the matrix, you know, and all this politics going on. And he said, yes, yes. She said, okay. In the beginning, she said, no, I don't want you to do it. She was afraid that it's a scam, that you might get ripped off. Like Carlton Sheets back then, you know, no money down. You've seen a commercial, infomercial on TV.
I mean, any of the financial, hey, you know, join us and we'll teach you how to do this. I mean, yeah, there's always a massive concern about that. Michael Blanc, I've heard a lot of good things about his program.
Yeah, so those ones, infomercials that say, you know, so then I told my wife, I said, no, you know what? This guy is different. I'm willing to take a chance on him. And she was skeptical, but I convinced her. It was hard to convince your wife to spend the time, 15 grand. Okay, that was hard to, when you have no income. When you left your job, you know what I'm saying? Like,
in what year was this?
I think it was 2017 or 18, somewhere around there, 17 or something.
15 grand when prices were half what they are now.
Yeah, and then finally she said, okay. And so I took a leap of faith, basically. Then I joined this program and I wanted to see what it was all about. And then I got my first deal done. So I was, you know, I was happily surprised that it wasn't a scam. The first one was 56 unit in Moore, Oklahoma, which is OKC. And then I did very well with that deal, very well with that deal. So that's how I got my financial freedom, basically. From that deal. So that's how I learned multifamily and syndication. And that's how I propelled into this venture freedom role now. And now I'm having my own fund, like a fund manager to buy multifamily. I have a small little private mastermind or mentorship to just how to raise money and become a fund manager or raise as a co-GP, raising capital, small, very small, like a few students I'm taking right now. That's all.
For your fund, so your first deal is 56 units. So how big was that deal?
$1.8 million I bought it for and had to raise $750,000.
So that was first deal, which is pretty, I mean, that's sizable. And then now your funds that you're doing, so how many funds have you, I mean, you're launching, how big are they? What do they buy?
Mm-hmm. I've done like 14 deals. I was the lead sponsor of most of them. I've done raising capital. I've done key principal. I've done LP, like two deals. And my fund is $20, $30 million. I want to acquire three multifamily, over 100 units in Texas and Arizona primarily. So Phoenix and Dallas, where I live, and like San Antonio and Austin areas. That's what I'm doing right now. I'm trying to find the next deal for my fund. So when it does, I'll launch it and I'll raise the equity for it. So yeah, and helping students do their first deal right now too as well.
How many total doors do you have ownership interest in?
2,345 doors. I've done 100 million transactions in the past 6 years.
My God, that's impressive.
That's fantastic. You said 2045?
2345.
2345, okay. Yep.
I'm curious about, you know, a little kind of like switching gears, if it's all right, to parenting and whatnot. You've gone down this journey where you realize that like happiness is a little bit more important than living your parents' dream. And so I'm curious how you're raising your daughter. Like, is your wife that Asian tiger mom? And is your education culture, that Asian education culture where like she just can't go out, lock yourself in your room, learn stuff. How close or far removed from that type of culture are you?
So my wife is more westernized than just an Asian tiger mommy, because she was born here in New York. And she kind of listens to what I say. What she's just concerned about is not, yeah, she agrees that you follow your heart and passion. She agrees with that. She's just worried that my daughter needs to make money and survive. And I said, don't worry. I said, I'm building a nest egg and she can do what she wants. She just follows her passion and her heart. You don't worry about money, I told her. And as we continue to grow in scale, she can see, I'm convincing her that, yeah, that is possible. That is, we can build that dream that we want. And you don't have to worry too much. Let's worry about the money and her survival versus, but she wants her to get a good job and good school like my mom. I said, yeah, she can go to school, get a good school and job, and let her choose what she wants. Just to follow her heart. That's what I told her. My wife's saying, oh, get a good job, maybe a pharmacist. Like, kind of like in way my mom is saying, but I said, no, I told her, go less away from that and focus on what's important.
So I have a question here. You said your wife was more westernized because she was born here in the United States. And then right after that, you said, so she listens to me when I say things. Is that characteristic of a little bit more of a Western interpersonal relationship where an Asian woman who's born in one of the Asian, you know, Vietnam or Chinese would not listen to her husband?
No, it depends on the individual. I think that if you're ethnically Chinese or Vietnamese, you may listen, but depends on their raising of the viewpoint of their parents. Because if you're really like hardcore like Korean or hardcore Japanese or hardcore Vietnamese, there's certain cultures ingrained in your culture for many, many years. And if you don't like the way your husband or spouse talk things or thinks things differently, you may not agree to that raising your kid that way. So it depends.
I love hearing some of these cultural, you know, things that are just differences between, you know, the different way that cultures are. And, you know, and for this particular interview, I love being educated about how some of these, interpersonal relationships work that, you know, we don't necessarily hear about. So your wife and you were raising your daughter. Trevor, we were following up on, you know, the aha moment and then raising your daughter now. So let's go into that. So your daughter is growing up and your wife and you both care about her well-being, of course, but there's not as much of the Asian demands to perform and do what is told. Is that accurate?
Yeah, my wife is more like not too pushy because she don't want her like to study all day long and be like a Asian tiger mommy. But she want her to excel in arts. Like, she plays piano, may violin, may tennis. So in a way, she's a tiger mommy in those sense that she wants her to do activities. She wants to be, you know, kind of well-rounded and grow and do well in school. She's naturally brilliant, my daughter. So she is a tiger mommy in that sense. But she's not like the traditional mommy where in my mom's generation where they say, oh, you must be this. Because remember, they don't speak English. They don't know the American culture as we do. They came from a different world, different culture. They came from like the Chinese background back in the old days where, hey, you should be a doctor. You should be a lawyer. You should be someone who's esteemed and get a good job so you can hold the last name with the surname.
I never thought about that from the surname standpoint. You know, I love hearing these stories of, you know, individuals coming here and taking advantage of, you know, the American dream and also doing the work for it. But I also love hearing about this, or find very interesting is, you know, you're also mentioning a lot of, you know, culture that you're bringing to the U.S., which I find really great in that it's a lot of this like kind of deep work ethic stuff. And, you know, because right now we've got, you know, somewhat of cultural wars, you know, we're kind of seeing just in general, you know, what are your thoughts regarding cultural identification in the modern time? And this is just a total, any thought that you have is, you know, appreciative, but people who don't, maybe the stereotype of millennials not wanting to work, or even, you know, potential large amounts of immigrants who are coming in where people are saying, hey, we're embodying a lot of foreign cultural things that are coming to the U.S. that aren't necessarily U.S. values. What are your thoughts regarding those?
I think what we see here is overall in general, a degradation of morals and culture. What happens is even in Asian culture, like Japan, Korea, they're facing birth rate is very low, even like Italy and Europe. And that's a common theme. And what that means is you're not valuing traditional marriage and family values of having a kid and having a legacy for your wealth. If you just have no kids and you have no one to pass along your tradition, your values as a mom or dad or as a family legacy. So a lot of people, what I understood was these younger generation don't want to deal with dating, don't want to deal with fighting, don't want to deal with this issue. So they try to stay single as long as possible, or they get separated and want to be by themselves and they want to fulfill themselves through like other means. Like in Japan, you just go to, you can go to like play a video game or do whatever you need to do to fill your own happiness, but ignore the other parts. So I think that is going to be an issue, because that's not that you can't have no legacy and no kids. That the true happiness comes from your kids and your family, and that's what you're missing. And they don't understand that. And that's the issue I see, because the older generation understands that, but the newer one doesn't.
Did you feel that same way or have that same expectation prior to having your daughter? Or when you had your daughter, was there like more of a light bulb moment?
No. I always wanted a kid and family. I always wanted a traditional route, because I'm 48, so I'm a little older than, I'm not a millennial, I'm not a younger person. So my views are more like traditional. And I believe in the traditional route where you have kids, and somebody is happy because she gives me a lot of happiness. I spend time with her. And that's worth more than anything else, you know? To be honest with you, right? So
I felt the same way in that I always wanted kids, but I didn't have a light bulb moment. And really what you kind of said was that, you know, once you have kids, life is so much better. Now you realize, you know, why you're doing it, all these things. And I wanted kids always, but it wasn't until my son came out that I was like, whoa, now I see it. You know, now I see this actual breakpoint. And I feel like with a lot of individuals who are kind of on that, you know, haven't had kids yet side, is that they don't actually recognize that, or maybe they haven't had that moment go off where they actually see there's a difference. And you hear a lot of people kind of say that, where they go, life without kids is kind of vacuous. And I wouldn't have said that before I had kids, but now that I have kids, I'm like, yeah, I really actually agree, because it's just such a night and day difference. Trevor, what do you think?
I agree 100%. I mean, it's obviously a life-changing event. It's totally changed your whole perspective on things. Jonathan, I'm real curious if, because I want to get my daughter into tennis, and you mentioned that she's doing that now. Was that intentional? Did you encourage her to go into tennis? Did you do things beforehand to kind of develop the lower half of the body before the upper half so they could eventually work together? Like, how did that journey go, getting her into that sport?
Well, I asked her, me and my wife said, do you want to learn tennis? She said, yeah, she wants it, so she likes it. So then we signed up here at a local tennis that has coaching, and then she liked it. So every week she goes, you know, several times, and then we support her in that. So she likes it. I said, whatever you like, daddy will pay for it, and I'll support you on it. And I never had the opportunity when I was young. When I was young, we had no money. I just played against a brick wall or a blue ball, and I played myself playing racquetball just against a wall, you know, the blue ball. And I had no opportunity to join anything or go play, like, you know, do certain things that needed money, basically.
Well, how old was that when you asked her if she wanted to do tennis? How old was she?
Oh, I don't remember. I think it was a few, she's 11. That's maybe a few years ago. I think it was like a few years ago. Yeah, a few years ago I did that. Yeah, and so, yeah.
Was she doing other sports before that?
No, she did tennis, and then she was in Chinese school for a while, and then she's doing viola, and now she's piano, and she likes dancing. That's what she likes. We give her a try. She really likes dancing. We should like, give her dancing, like, so we could give her that. And what she don't like it, we don't continue.
Gotcha.
That's what we do.
And is she involved in your business at all as well?
She helped me do sales tax each month. So how to pay sales tax, because when your daughter is like 10 years old or higher, you can deduct those taxes. And I said, one day, if you're interested, just let me know. You can maybe help daddy. But I said, it's up to you. I'm not going to force you. Like how my dad forced us to be a dentist or a pharmacist or a doctor. So I'm not going to force you. It's up to you at the end of the day. So,
you know, I'm a big advocate of the financial education for kids young. You know, I really am. And you hear certain cultures that bring it in very young. And, you know, Jewish families bring it in very, very young. I don't know how many Asian families, but hearing you do that with your daughter, you know, where she's just even getting exposed to it is really cool.
Yeah. So I try to explain to her about, like, we had the financial literacy book and try to read it with her. And she asked me questions and try to explain how it was a mortgage. And she asked good questions. I'll explain to her how it works. So she understands kind of the high level. I said, when you get older, I can teach you more in detail. But right now, as a young kid, it's high level. What is a mortgage debt? She said that, what is a lawsuit? I said, someone who's not happy who takes you to court, like a judge makes you pay. So stuff like that, you know. So she asked me questions like that.
I mean, you are just all in on this, like a polar opposite approach from how you were raised, where there's almost like no direction, like you need to do this, you need to do this. It's just, do you want to do this? And providing encouragement. Like you just went all in on that theory, on that way of parenting.
Because I learned something very valuable. In life, it's you have to follow your passion, what you like. Take to the highest level and continue. And synchronicity will take you to the right path that will go around and make you go to the right direction to the North Star. That's what I realized.
Yeah, well, it's a lot easier to love what you're doing, to work hard when you love what you're doing. If you don't love what you're doing and you're just chugging out hours after hours after hours, you're not going to excel if you're doing something that isn't exciting.
exciting and turning your brain on. You want to work more.
Yes. I can give you an example of how your passion will make money. So, for example, there's one lady who loved dancing, but she's older now. So she's a little embarrassed about like dancing. But then she danced a little bit and she liked it. And then she decided to open her own studio for older people who are like over 40 years old to dance and not be shy and maybe teach them how to dance, like, you know, salsa or whatever it is. And now she makes money through her passion and not just become a doctor or lawyer, but something that she really loves and wants to help people not get embarrassed. So you're older, but it doesn't matter. You still dance. So that's an example of follow your heart and passion. The money will follow.
That's great. And so with your business now, so how much are you home? How much are you at work? And how much family time do you get with your wife and daughter? Because you're doing a lot of, I mean, this is busy. I mean, you've got several funds. You've got, you know, over 2,300 units. You've done over $100 million in deals. And I'll go forward, like, how's your work balance between, you know, being able to see your daughter, which you said is your why, and doing all the work?
Yeah, so my wife helped me with my business. So she's like my asset manager for self-storage. So we talk to her every single day. We walk together in the morning every day, 1 hour to exercise, walking together. Sometimes we have lunch together. And then in the evenings, if I have no meetings or no meetups, I spend time with my family eating dinner every night. And on the weekend, I unplug. I spend time with my family. We go vacation. We go do things together. We go enjoy eating out. It's on the weekend, so I spend a lot of time with them. On the weeknights, on some nights I can, but sometimes I'm very busy. So I spend more on my weekends. And then it goes around your kids' school summer. So like, for example, spring break was last week. We were in LA. We went to beautiful Disneyland, Catalina Islands, Santa Monica Pier, and we had a great time. This is spending 4 or 5 days together. And then we're planning on August, my birthday, go to Vancouver. And I might go on a weekend to Houston just to check out the certain restaurant, certain place we want to check out in 2 weeks. So having the freedom to do that lets me to go wherever I want to. My daughter's off school. So we think planning maybe go to Taiwan next year for a month, for example, 2 or 3 weeks. And at some time we can go anywhere we want to because she's had no school. So having that freedom, we spend a lot of time together. I'm here, I'm home every day with my family. I work from home. So I do have a lot of time with them, especially on the weekends. On the weekdays, I'm usually very busy. But at nighttime, I can always see them and have dinner with them. I'm always here normally, unless I go to a meetup or some kind of meeting. But I'm here most of the time with them. And when we're free, we go and travel places where we want to go.
What time of day does that... I'm curious about your schedule, Jonathan, because I'm always trying to hack my time usage myself and, you know, figure out the best way to structure my day and spend my time. So, and my actually day sounds actually very similar to yours. You know, me and my wife, we have coffee every morning for an hour. Then I hop on the computer and get to work. What time do you generally do that walk and then start your work? And then do you have a typical pending, you're not going to a meetup or networking event, right? Do you have like a typical cutoff time where you kind of just stop working?
I do. I wake up like 7:30. Then we exercise for 1 hour, me and my wife. And then I come back, I eat a healthy breakfast, I take a shower, and then I come back and I meditate for like 20 minutes. And then that's called a miracle morning routine, what I do. And then I start my day at around 10:30, and I work until like probably 6 p.m. and I cut it off and I stop. Then I have dinner, and then I spend time with my family. Now I might have one meeting at night for my student, but those days are maybe 2 nights out of the 5 nights, weeknights. Time I watch TV, and I spend time at dinner, talk to my daughter and, you know, hug her and hold her and play with her. That's the time that I have with my family. And then the weekends is my family. I don't devote time to any students I know and not my business. Unless she has to do something on her own and I have some time myself, I get focused on my business.
I have a question regarding, and you mentioned this a couple of times, and I love hearing the mindset stuff regarding work philosophy. But, you know, you mentioned, you know, life is the journey. Life has ups and downs. Have passion, the miracle morning, meditation. How much of this was learned? How much of it came from your parents? How much of it came from, you know, your work environment and finding a more, I don't want to call it spiritual, but a designation of mental planning for going through life and finding passions and proper direction? Like, how did you hone some of those practices in regards to what you're doing?
Michael Blanc was my inspiration, and he has what are called goals. And on his podcast, he shared these really good nuggets. Basically, every quarter, you need some of those smart goals, and you need rocks, quarterly rocks, and you gain traction. So one of it is your personal life, your dating life with your wife, make sure that's going, your personal health, and your financial liquidity, your business. So how's your business, your health, and then your love life. Those are three kind of cornerstones, and then tithing, donating back to others. So you have like four corner pillarstones that you have to break out in your goals that you set for the year, and each quarter you benchmark them. How am I doing? And because of that, that's how I learned. And also he invited speakers like Hal Elrod, the Miracle Morning. That's how I learned about the Miracle Morning. He does a little more extensive steps. I do more simplified steps. But it's from those people who personally almost, he died and came back, basically, how Al Rod, he died in an accident. It was a miracle how he came back because source or inertial consciousness or a god or someone helped him put his body back.
You're going to have to back up. So Miracle Morning at Elon, who is this individual? And tell us about this Miracle Morning.
In the New York Times bestseller, he's a very motivational speaker. Michael Blanc's stage, I met him. He lives here in Texas, and he had a very tragic accident that broke every single bone in his body. He died in the crash. And it was a freaking miracle that this guy got healed by the grace of, we call it source energy. You may call it God. And basically, over time, he came walking again and gave him motion ski. And he implemented, he calls it Miracle Morning, which means that he used to sell knives, kaku knives, you know, those little expensive knives. And it's very hard to sell those knives as a sales guy. It's very hard. Like, you go knock on the door. And, well, Mr. Smith, would you want to buy a set of knives? No, it's named on you. So what he used his miracle where he meditated. He does certain steps in his book. And then by the grace of source or synchronicity, Miracle Morning, he one day went to the house because he had a goal, yeah, a sales quota to make $25,000 by the certain month. It was the last day of the month. He was off by like $5,000. He had to sell the most expensive package to get his quota, be the winner of the sales year. And he had an appointment with the house. He went there and he knocked on the door and he said, is Mr. Smith here? He said, I'm sorry, he's on vacation. I'm his cousin visiting from Switzerland. He said, oh, really? And he got so upset, so like disappointed. It's his birthday, but I'm looking for a gift, so I don't mind you coming in and giving me a demonstration of what you want to sell. Then he's like, oh my God. And he's like, oh wow, this is synchronicity or the Miracle Morning. And then he came and he did his presentation. She was, I love it. I want to buy two sets of those. He got the $5,000 right there and he made his quota. And he said, from that day, he implemented a system of Miracle Morning and he told the others and it worked every single time. Basically, it's, you have to believe in yourself, meditate and work really, really hard, but meditate, miracle, and do these steps, and you achieve those goals that you never think is attainable. That's basically a short version of it, basically.
All right, I'm gonna put that one on my list.
Definitely put that.
Yeah, it's good. So the Slack channel on the website, you know, we try to put a list on the website for the podcast for, you know, ease of information, contact there for you, and also, you know, books recommended, and Miracle Morning will be one that we can add to that for sure.
Yeah, it's a really good book. Really good book.
No, I'll check it out, definitely. Trevor, what's do you have any other questions? I mean, I've got so many actually, but I don't want to jump around too much.
I got my most, the biggest questions I have out. Let's hear yours.
You know, I've got so many questions about, I guess I am interested in this is because it's a different world from my upbringing. But within the culture, you know, however your brothers call it, either westernized or have they maintained, you know, some of the Vietnamese Chinese culture that was brought over, you know, you've got this kind of mindset of having your daughter, you know, excel at the things that she likes, which is fantastic. And how have they been? Because they both go down that doctor lawyer. You know, you were the CPA, but did they do the other two of the big three?
My brother, oldest brother, a dentist. He went to NYU, went to Columbia for a postdoctorate, and he's doing well. He's happy. And my other brother was a little confused like me. He started in finance with Merrill Lynch. Then he started to try a business, wholesale business, but didn't do well. Then I got him a job in tax to help him get a job. And I realized he's not a business guy because he forgets a lot. So my wife told him, just do a regular job and he'd be fine. So he has a regular job. He does, I used to do taxes. I mean, his wife works in the same company. So they both have just a corporate job, basically. But he has a different mindset from me. He don't understand all these things that I understand. So me and him are not on the same wavelength. But it's okay. He's my brother and that's fine. So.
He let you crash on his couch for a while.
Yes. Yeah.
Sounds like a good guy.
He's a good guy. He's a very great guy. It's just that we don't think the same, basically.
What about your eldest brother? I'm assuming you've been talking about your middle brother this whole time. What's it like with your elder brother? Is he still in the picture?
Well, he's
Bill. Yeah, he's
one's dentist.
Yes. He's a dentist and, you know, he likes his dentistry, which I'm very happy. He works a lot. His wife is a podiatrist. And she does it part-time, mostly a housewife. I haven't asked the question of how he raised his kids, so I don't really know. But I know that his daughter is going to Boston University, and she's trying to do some kind of, I assume, some kind of medical field.
Has your brother LP'd in any of your deals?
Yes, he did, in one or two of my deals. Yes.
That's good.
My oldest brother, yes.
So where's he located at?
He lives in New Jersey, where I grew up in New Jersey.
So. Yeah. So let's change topics a little bit. So politics. I love always getting the take on this. So politics and business. So where do you think we are politically And I'll start with that one first. Like, what are your thoughts on just the state of the country, election year, and, you know, everything that's just happening that it's hard to kind of stay away from in some media?
Right. So geopolitics and politics, yes. So we live in a very dangerous world, more than ever. We have a person like Putin who is attacking and killing innocent people, which is very bad. We've never seen that when I grew up. Don't have Ronald Reagan and the Bush senior. It was more peaceful in the 80s where I grew up. So I didn't see this much dangerous world as my kids are living through right now, your kids are living through right now. And then we also have terrorism, which is something that we never had in the 80s growing up. So in this generation, our kids are facing a lot of dangerous situations. You have China on the rise with Taiwan. You have Russia trying to be like almost like a Hitler trying to conquer like Europe. And he doesn't want to stop at Ukraine. He wants to like take back, become the great Soviet Union. Like in the past, Stalin, that's his ambitions. And he wants to take the oil and all that resource that could be benefit Russia. So he has to be stopped, the number one. He has to be stopped. That's the biggest takeaway. To prevent Xi Jinping from taking over Taiwan and Iran being emboldened to attack, you know, in the Middle East. Because once Iraq fell down, Iran became the big player in the Middle East. So it's no longer Saddam Hussein. It was more like this Ayatollah, radical regime of Islam, and very strict. And what happens is they will attack Western forces because they don't like the hegemony of the United States and the allies. And they're saying that you're always oppressing us. So we're going to attack and fight. But sometimes there's radical groups like Al-Qaeda and all these things like that, like Hamas, that could be skewed this Bible in an incorrect way. So they say it's a religious holy war, but it's really not a holy war. So you have bad actors who are skewing the Quran or the Bible into their own benefit, basically. That's bad. So you have evil forces in the world that is dark, and that's not good. So you have Putin, then you have China who wants to be almost like a dictator for life, which is not good. Iran has some issues because they sponsor terrorism, like the Houthis and all these people. They're almost like pirates attack, you know, ships, like Japanese ships for no reason, take the money and, you know, so they have to be stopped. So us as a global leader the free world have to uphold our values or our allies and protect the seas, and we have to be united. The problem here was too divisive. And I see a big issue in this MAGA Republican Party. Because what happens is they're taking for his own interests. It's not the Ronald Reagan, the John McCain. Ronald Reagan Republican is not what we see now. Right now you see the Trump Republican, the MAGA Republican, the lady who's always speaking, Marjorie, the Greens always speaking out. And that's not how you're supposed to work in Congress. You're elected to help and move the agenda forward. Now you can have debates about policy where it doesn't work. So you can have great meaningful policy and debates, but you're not supposed to demonize one another on TV. That's where the standard went downhill in America. That's why we look bad in front of the whole world. We look like we're like little kids in kindergarten fighting and not getting along and not helping. We're supposed to be the leader of the free world, not supposed to be the kindergarten, you know, that's the issue we're facing here. And unfortunately, the way that our former president talks, it doesn't help either, right? The cause, because he talks like the janitor. That's also another issue I see. So we need to have better, you know, higher moral, higher integrity in our system and elect people who can actually do good for the people. So you have to be more like, in a way, you have to be more independent and have people who want to fight for the country for the right reasons, effectively. You don't have to call yourself a label, like I'm putting the Democrat, but just good people who will fight for the cause of America. And you can debate each other, but ultimately come with the best solution and move forward. That's what you got to do. And that's the issue we see with America, that we're in a decline because we can't agree with each other. We're just the fewest rules that we ever done in our lifetime. And I'm more like an independent, so I don't support one or the other, but I'm just saying that. So
yeah, we talk about some of these things quite a bit on here. And, you know, and myself, I'm the more conservative side, but, you know, in regards very specifically to Marjorie Taylor Greene or a lot of these, you know, I'll call it clickbaitable politicians, where, you know, they're saying things that are so salacious because it gets them press.
Gets them elected.
Well, it gets eyeballs, it gets clicks, you know, it gets clicks, and the clicks, you know, is the marketing. And I think, you know, in the Republican and Democrat Party, you know, both of them, I just get upset because, you know, if you end up saying, well, I am a Republican, you know, then that means that you're kind of like identifying with, you know, one particular party, which doesn't necessarily encapsulate, you know, what you want to do. It's just kind of one of these boxes we kind of got shoved into in kind of a way, you know, and that's generally my upset. So yeah, I'm falling more on the independent side. There are a lot of things that I would, you know, I'm a pro on the liberal side for. My concern on the same thing is that I just get concerned on where they're spending the money. I just get concerned that, you know, even if you say, hey, it's just cause I like, but I just don't think the money's going to get allocated accordingly. And, you know, we get unfortunately stuck in the middle. But
so Max, what we need is an independent person who's not being biased to one person or one item. because when you do that, you become sort of a Putin or Xi Jinping.
The amount of politicians who are sponsored by a lot of private interest, private companies who are, you know, putting their funding dollars into the politicians, you know, I think that stuff should be a lot more public, you know, so you really see exactly, you know, who is kind of paid for by who. I would really like it if we had a more independent government that wasn't so merged with the private sector. I really would.
Right, right. Because what we need is, yeah, we need good people to actually run the country. And not like this, because this bickering is hurting us and it's not solving the issue. So me as a regular person, a regular human being, a middle class guy, I said, I want to see you move forward. I want you to work hard. I want to see the country forward. We're the leader of the free world. You have to show your respect. And the way you also talk is important. Your character is important. It's very important, your character. You can't say, hey, you know, whatever, you know, like you can't, you're shown a light that is so high that you're above like a lawyer or a doctor. You're like, if you're the president, you're like, you're up there, you know, you're like number one guy in the whole world. You're not like an average person like me, you know, and you shouldn't talk like that, you know, so that's the issue I have. It's a character issue, you know, so.
Character issue. Yeah. I'm going to go on to market. Trevor, do you want to talk politics before I jump over?
I don't know. Do you want to see me? You want to see my blood boil?
I mean, we could have the friendly conversation. You know, the conversation was going to go to, you know, just in regards to business. You know, you've got these units that are coming out. We've got a lot of inflation in the market. You know, and the politics is sometimes a little bit I'll call it segue over to just the market. You know, what are your thoughts regarding what's going to happen here within the next, I'll call it 12 out to 36 to 60 months? You know, where do you, like, how do you see things in regards to your business and, you know, any thoughts you have?
Well, I hope I can grow my business to scale. I'm just an average person trying to work hard like a dad. I hope the government does their job and do well. I pray, hope they do as well. I hope the Federal Reserve lowers the rates to help us in real estate. And I hope that, you know, we have a better future for our kids. And I wish we had better candidates too, to be honest with you. We only have two candidates that we've seen before, so I'm not too happy about that. So,
they just keep getting worse, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, I need someone who has the right ideas and the right things.
Looks like he did, but I'm sure he'll be back.
I'm just an average person who wants to love a country. I just want a country to move forward and take it for our kids and our grandkids. Like I said, I'm not of any affiliation. I just want someone who's hardworking, who does good for a country and move country forward. And that's it.
Well said.
Yeah, that was really good, Jonathan. It was really enjoyable listening to your story and chatting with you, man.
Yeah, this was a really great episode. The background that you came from, you know, the hardworking side, the philosophical side, all really great stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah, so we love hearing the stories about people who are working hard and getting rewarded for it, you know, and you've had some great accomplishments. You know, your move from the CPA world, how was that pay cut? When you were working Wall Street and went to, you know, I'll call it, I mean, of course, when you stop working a job, it goes from, you know, whatever high pay to zero, but, you know, in the rearview mirror now, I mean, you're now, you've got a big portfolio of properties. How is it now compared to, you know, that Wall Street job?
It's good. I mean, I make more money than my other job and it's growing. And I help, my job is to help people. I want to help, like, yes, if you want to come to me, I recommend to help you grow your stock, I help you. And that's what my job is. I'm an agent of love and light, positivity. I don't like darkness or negativity. So I'm here to help promote positive vibes and love and help you see the North Star so that you can understand that being a good person and being a dad is worth it for you to, you know, if you want to have kids, it's a great thing. And you'll enjoy it basically.
And Jonathan, here is We Also Tell, I'm going to mark this again. How do guests get in contact with you?
They can reach me through email, jonathan@graystonecapgroup.com, or visit my website. I have free resources on DD checklist, what's passive investing in commercial real estate on my website, graystonecapgroup.com.
Wonderful. And we'll also have a link to Jonathan's contact information on our website, therealestatedadspodcast.com. And we'll also have a link to the book that we were referencing, The Miracle Morning, and that philosophy that book encourages. So Jonathan, thanks so much for being on. We really appreciate you. And this has been a great episode.
Thank you very much, guys. Have a great day.